Welcome to the ABM Conversations Podcast, the number one podcast for B2B marketers wanting to explore timeless account-based marketing strategies to drive revenue, customer engagement, retention, and everything that makes sense to both marketers and sales folks. No more fluff. No more vanity metrics. Live from India, made for the world. And now your hosts, Yog and Manish.
Welcome to yet another episode of the ABM Conversations Podcast. This is me, your host, Manish Nepal.
And this is me, Yagneshwaran Ganesh.
If you have been in the world of marketing, our today's guest needs no introduction. Rand Fiskin. Welcome to the show, Rand.
Thanks for having me, Manish.
Rand, I think it'll be great to start with a short bio of yourself in your own words. Why don't you give our audience a little bit of a background of what you have done in the past and what you're doing right now?
Sure. So I suspect a lot of folks know me from my previous company. I started a company called Moz, based here in Seattle, Washington, where I live. That company was initially a consulting firm that helped folks with SEO and then became a software company, raised some venture capital. I was the CEO there for 7 years while the company sort of grew rapidly, and then stepped down from the role and left the company about 2.5 years ago and started a new company called SparkToro, which helps with market research and audience intelligence. And in between the companies, I wrote and published a book called Lost and Founder, which a lot of folks have read now, and that's been exciting. I also do a lot of, well, before the pandemic, I did a lot of travel and speaking, and many folks may know me from a video series that I did for Moz as well called Whiteboard Friday, and I've been an active publisher of content of all kinds around web marketing.
Absolutely, and we are going to touch upon a lot of what you said just now deeper in the show. But let me start with my first question, which is in August 2019, you published an article titled Less Than Half of Google Searches Now Result in a Click. You published it in SparkToro blog, and that made quite a noise in the SEO and marketing and Twitter world, right? For people who don't know about it, Rand, can you give a brief context of what you unearthed in that research and what the findings meant for businesses as well as the common people?
Yeah, sure. So basically, my goal was to understand the distribution of where and how Google sends traffic when someone performs a search. That research started, you know, a few years ago, and I had been tracking the numbers around clicks and searches for some time, thanks to help from a clickstream data provider called Jumpshot, which unfortunately shut down at the beginning of this year. But in, I think it was June of last year, we finally crossed the 50% mark, meaning that 50%, more than 50% of all searches resulted in zero clicks to any property outside of Google. You know, that to my mind is a signal, right? It's been growing for a long time. It continues to grow. I actually did some data gathering with SimilarWeb in June of this year, and you can see the numbers keep going up. But the reality is that there's less Google search traffic available, not because fewer people are searching, but because Google themselves are cannibalizing, taking that opportunity away from publishers and website owners. And that is a tough reality to live in, but it's also, I think, a future that all of us have to face and deal with and figure out how we want to plan for it. I think that means, you know, I assume Yag and Manish that the two of you have been, you know, trying to figure out what to do around your businesses. Certainly for us at SparkToro, what we have been thinking very strongly about is how do we build up a traffic and marketing strategy that is not wholly reliant on Google, because they are not a reliable traffic partner, I think, for the long-term future.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's high time that people, especially in the business and marketing world, should start for better, safer alternatives. And yeah, like you said, it's uncertain. But let me jump to my second question, which is, this is going to be a little semi-personal in nature. But when we, the common marketers, think of Rand Fiskin, the brand that you have created, three things come to our minds. Number one is your signature hair and pirate styled mustache. And Moz's Whiteboard Fridays, definitely, where your simplified marketing concept as this wizard of the Moz. And number three is your very upfront take on the status quo around marketing, right? And for my next question, let me dig a little deeper on the last one. For instance, despite the huge success of the Whiteboard Fridays, you have always said it in public that you don't attribute its success to any genius thinking, but just the fact that you guys at Moz got lucky, right? And you have also made it very clear to non-marketers why content marketing fails or it doesn't work in the same way that they imagine. You have also attempted to do similar things in your book, Lost and Founder. So what gives? Why is Rand Fiskin so different from other marketers or business gurus who, I believe, if given a chance, would have claimed all the credit for the success of Whiteboard Friday and exaggerated the advent of content marketing as the greatest thing since white bread?
I mean, gosh, I think it's, Manish, it's a little bit style and also what feels appropriate, right? I think that, look, the reality behind Whiteboard Friday is I was not the person who came up with the idea for the very first one, right? I was in the office with some coworkers. I was explaining something to them on a whiteboard. One of them suggested getting the camera that we had bought and filming it and putting it on the blog. I agreed. How does that make me a genius? Does that make the coworker who came up with the idea the genius? I mean, the first one was not very successful, right? So was the genius idea sticking with it? Who decided on that? It was mostly me because I was lazy and didn't want to blog, right? I wanted a night off from blogging because I was doing it five nights a week. So yeah, it's pretty tough to say, right? Who's a genius? I think it is luck, right? A lot of it is circumstance and being fortunate and being early, having that community that supported what we were doing. Look, I agree with you. I think there are a lot of folks in the business world, in the marketing world, who would sort of take credit for these things more, you know, with less humility. But that's not my style. It doesn't feel appropriate or, I don't know what to call it, right to me. You know, that's not the way I like to do things. That could be just a, whatever it is, a cultural difference. It could be a matter of what I feel is ethical, but yeah, you're just not going to find me embracing that style.
Right. I think also it's kind of more like there is a certain power to serendipity. When you do good things happen. And one of the things that I've always loved about what you do, Rand, is that you've been very passionate about solving problems for content marketers, something that connects deeply with both me and Manish as well. So, you know, let's kind of unpack this a little bit. How different is SparkToro in the kind of problems that it solves compared to what you did at Moz for content marketers?
Yeah, I mean, SparkToro is very, very different. I don't think there's any overlap really between the two companies' products or what they help with, right? So SparkToro is really designed to help solve this problem that we talked about earlier with Google's, you know, zero-click issue. My goal is to help marketers find sources of influence, places that they can draw traffic from outside of Google and Facebook, right? I want to help everyone discover channels and sources of influence that are not just bound to these two big properties, right? Because I think both of them are taking away a ton of opportunity, and we should look outside of those. So what SparkToro does is essentially it crawls billions of web and social profiles. And then it uses the data extracted from those to find the sources of influence for any given audience, right? So you search for, I want to find people who talk about snowboarding, and it can tell you, SparkToro can tell you what websites people who talk about snowboarding online visit, and what podcasts they listen to, and what YouTube channels they're subscribed to, and what social media accounts they follow, right? And then you can go do marketing of all kinds in all of those places instead of relying exclusively on Google. And the best part, when you do marketing in those places, Google tends to reward you, right? You get mentioned on a podcast, you get linked to, you get talked about on a YouTube channel, you get more branded search, you get more people recognizing you. Your rankings are going to go up.
Right, right. It makes a lot of sense because, you know, basically when I just do a mere Google search, it all kind of gives me wrong kinds of signals. For example, if I search for Rand Fishkin, the first thing that it tells me is Rand Fishkin's net worth.
which is, by the way, wrong. I really need to write a blog post with my own actual bank statements because, oh my God, there's people out there who think I have a lot of money and I should talk to them and see if they can give it to me.
right, amazing. And you know, one of the interesting things that I also wanted to discuss is a very interesting term that you guys use at SparkToro, the term called audience intelligence, because we often come across terms like customer intelligence or even revenue intelligence for that matter. But what exactly is audience intelligence? And since you have a strong SEO background, I can't help not asking you this question. Like, how many customers ended up signing up for SparkToro using the term audience intelligence?
Zero, as far as I know.
Okay.
Audience intelligence, intentionally, we use this phrase, which was very uncommon, right? Very few searches per month. We obviously didn't rank for it until recently. I think we now are somewhere in the top 10 sometimes. But you know, we've only been around for 4 months, 4.5 months. So it's pretty new. But we chose audience intelligence because it describes what we actually do, right? So we knew that lots of people would say, I don't know what audience intelligence is. What is that? And then they'd have to go and figure it out.
Right.
And in the early days of Moz, this was true of SEO as well. Right. So 2001, 2002, 2003, there were already communities of people doing SEO, obviously, but it was very poorly known across most of society, most of the marketing world, most of the web world, even. Right. And when people did know what SEO was, they had a bad impression of it. So, very similar to those early years at Moz, this time with SparkToro, we picked audience intelligence because what our product actually does is give you insight. Right? Useful. The way I describe audience intelligence and define it is useful, usable, actionable data about a group of people that you want to reach through marketing. Right? So if you are attempting to do marketing of any kind in any place, whether that's on your own website with your own content or in your emails or in your advertising, that you run on Google and Facebook, or in your podcasting strategy, or in your events marketing, or you name it, anything. You need to understand things about your customers. What do they talk about? What sorts of words and phrases do they use? Who do they follow and pay attention to? Where do they go online? Where are they located geographically, right? You sort of need this insight to be able to do a great job of talking to your customers. And That is what SparkToro provides. Audience intelligence is a very new field, right? I think, you know, if you do a search for it, you'll see maybe, I think there's maybe two other companies. One's called Audience with an E-N-S-E.
Right.
And then one is called Helixa.ai. But be careful, there's another Helixa that is not this one. There's like a Helix.ai. That's not the one. Anyway, but those two companies do something similar to SparkToro. You can't, I'm not 100% sure exactly what they do because they don't have their products kind of visible on the web. You got to take a demo. But that's this early field is the one that we're in.
Right, right. The very reason I asked this question is because, you know, I have used SparkToro and, you know, it's very easy to get started. And I also love the kind of emails that you send. It's very short and looks very personalized. It's not like a template. So I love the whole experience of it. And especially, you know, the part that I really loved is you also had written a blog specifically about how to make use of your first 10 searches for the month. So I think that was very, very useful.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'm glad you got to check that out. Yeah, one of the big challenges is, look, with SEO, right? Everyone knows what SEO is, right? You do some keyword research, you create some content, you build some links, you do some technical SEO, And you try and rank in Google's search engine. Great. That's, you know, very straightforward. People are familiar with it. Audience intelligence, I think people have more questions. Like, what do I need to know about my customers or my audience to be able to reach them? And I think that's more of a challenge for us to kind of explain both the problem and the solution. Again, really similar to the early days of SEO, where we had to tell, you know, for years I was getting on stages telling people, here's why you have to do keyword research. You have to do it because people type words into search engines. And when they do, they expect to find content that matches their search intent. And that took a long time until it was no longer necessary to say that. I suspect it's going to be a long time of me saying, you need to understand your audience and their behaviors and attributes online in order to better target them before people, you know, go, oh, right, of course I need to do that.
Right, absolutely makes sense. So before we go on any further, we also want to take a moment to thank our sponsors, that is Zest.is, who are a marketing content stream that sits on your Google Chrome browser as a new tab extension. And it's also a website where you can discover or submit high-quality articles, podcasts, infographics, videos, and ebooks. And it's a highly powered AI-based algorithm allows you to handpick your personalized content feed that is very specific to your taste.
And as marketers and content creators, Yag and I both use Zest a lot. And based on the feedback that we have been getting from you guys, our listeners, many of you also use Zest to promote as well as discover new content to and from like-minded marketing communities around the world. So if you want to show your support for what we are doing with this podcast, and if you want to further boost your high-quality content to an elite community of marketers, we have some good news for you. Sign up at zest.is/contentboost and get a $75 off on your first boost by letting them know that you heard it first from the AVM Conversations podcast. So, Rand, if we look at all the companies that you have co-founded so far, right, there is an interesting parallel that stands out. You have started out all of these companies either with a friend or an ex-colleague like Casey Henry is mm-hmm. for SparkToro, or with a minded professional like Hiten Sa, who gets marketing, or your mom, Zillian, who was your first ever co-founder, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Jillian was, so my mom was my co-founder at Moz. And then not Hiten, it was Dharmesh Shah and I, Dharmesh from HubSpot.
I'm sorry.
I started inbound.org. And then, yeah, Casey and I started SparkToro. I really like, I don't know, I like working with people that I like. Dharmesh and I, Casey and I, like, we share philosophies, we share personal friendships. Yeah, I mean, you know, we have our disagreements, of course, but it's very healthy. And I think that works well. I don't love doing things completely on my own. You know, Lost and Founder was kind of an exception where you're, you know, it's just you and the keyboard. But even there, I had a wonderful editor. Once I sort of sold the book, right, to the publisher, Penguin Random House, I worked with Nikki Papadopoulos out of New York. And Nikki and I had a great working relationship, right? And I think she made the book, my God, you guys, like 10 times better. No doubt about it, right? I think... you know, many folks think, oh, yeah, Rand is a good blogger, so he probably just sat down and wrote this thing. No.
Right. And Goodreads is a great testimony to what a great book that is, although I am yet to read it. But drawing for that from that parallel, Rand, it might be a bit far-fetched comparison, but I and Yag also started this podcast, and we have worked on other projects together, merely because of the serendipity of being colleagues in the same team, where we connected over our dislike for the same kind of bad marketing that was out there. But that's a completely different topic.
I love that. Passion. See, I think it is a wonderful thing to build a team with an antagonist.
Yeah.
That's that. Manish, I really resonate with that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So my question to you, Rand, is for people like us, who might one day build something amazing with a friend or a colleague, or maybe their moms, what are some tips on what to look for in each other or how to discover synergies?
Yeah, great question. So I have found a few things that I think need to be shared in order for a partnership to be successful. I think one of those is absolutely core values, right? What you believe is ethical and right, what you would not be willing to trade dollars for, right? So things that you would say, even though this might make us money, I am unwilling to do it. And if you share a conviction around that, hopefully the answer is not nothing. Hopefully you have some convictions beyond wealth generation. But if you share that, I think that truly helps. The second thing I've found really valuable is communication style. So even though you might communicate well, for example, like in person, if your communication style through other mediums doesn't match up, maybe one of you is great at email, one of you hates email, that tends to be a bad combination. One of you loves Slack and instant messaging and group chat, and the other one is like, no, I won't use that. That's not so good either, right? So I would urge you to find at least a communication medium that you share in common that you're both good at. My honest assessment there is written communication is very, very powerful. And if you can find a format that works for both or all of you, however many folks are part of your team, that is really healthy. The third thing I'd say, this is not not universal, but I do find that when you share passion and interest around the problem that you're solving, that is very helpful as well. So for example, Dharmesh and I both had a lot of passion for the marketing community, right? And wanting to enable and participate in dialogue with our fellow marketers. So a community like inbound.org was just a great match for us. Similarly, I think Casey and I share a real passion for aggregating data at scale and helping people find opportunities that are not just Google and Facebook marketing. And so that, again, you know, that's a place where we really wanted to contribute and work together. And I hope we're off to a good start. It's been obviously probably the worst year to launch a startup in, what, 90 years? But we're doing our best, and I think have a good shot at making it.
right, absolutely. I mean, you know, everything is changing, and still, you know, I think Spark.ro, if I look at it, I think even very recently you guys also launched, I think, an email feature as well. So I think it's all going good for you.
Yeah, just yesterday. That's right.
And you know, I love the part that you spoke about the things that you look for in your co-founders. One of the things that Manish and I connected the most with is that you know, we both are such you know, straightforward people. We speak without pulling punches, which does not go well with a lot of people. So that's something that we both connected with. And one of the things that I've observed works really well is instead of you know, straight away jumping into a marriage and starting a company, It's better off to take up those small side projects that we work together on to discover. It's more like, you know, having short dates and discovering if you are the right for each other, and then going into the long haul.
Yeah, I like that. That is very good advice, Yag. And in fact, that's something that Casey and I did for probably at least 6 months before we started the company together. We got together for coffees, or Geraldine and I went out with Casey and his family a number of times, and then we, you know, split off and chat about work stuff, and yeah, basically decided over the course of that period that, hey, this was a really interesting opportunity for us to pursue. So yes, I think that is absolutely right, and you can get a really good feel for working with someone by having those, yeah, as you called them, short dates. I think actually date is a really good, right? It's not a romantic date, but it's a business date.
Right.
You're going out and you're seeing if there's chemistry and if you work well together and if you solve problems in good ways and if the conflict that you have is healthy and the disagreements that you have are healthy and you can work through them. I think that's a really good thing. The other thing I do strongly urge folks to do before they build a business together is, even though it costs a little bit of money, I would put together a list of things that might go wrong, right? That might happen in the future that would be bad and negative and terrible in the business, and how you would respond to those, right? And write those down, have a process in place, and then sort of bring them to an attorney and make them part of your founding paperwork, right? So that way, this is, it's sort of like the advice that you get for a marriage, actually, right? The advice is work through all the bad scenarios in good faith when you're in a good place with your relationship, so that if things get to a bad place in the relationship, you can look back at a time when you had a lot of trust and a positive relationship and make the decision, you know, to follow through on the commitments you made earlier. That is, honestly, it's a lifesaver. Casey and I haven't even encountered any of these yet, but I'm still so grateful that we went through that process before starting the company.
Well, that's called a honeymoon period. So maybe you guys have...
Yeah. Exactly. In the honeymoon period, that's when you want to write all that stuff down, when you want to plan for, you know, bad and negative things in the future. Not in the moment. In the moment, there's too much emotion. There's too much, you know, conflict of feelings. There can be assumption of bad intent. Just work around that, right, by doing it early.
Right. Makes a lot of sense. Love that. All right. So moving on, you know, can you also talk us through a little bit about, you know, something interesting that I came across on your website? That is, you know, you spoke about boulder pushing versus marketing flywheels. And I would really love for you to talk a little bit about why does a marketing flywheel really work? You know, what's different with that?
Yeah. So this, what I call boulder pushing marketing is essentially when you are every time you are investing in a particular repeatable marketing tactic, right? That might be, I don't know, a social media post. It might be an email. It usually is the most common boulder pushing marketing form that I see out there is advertising, right? You buy an ad from Google. It costs you whatever, $2.20 for every click that you get. Over time, hopefully you're maybe doing something that improves conversion rate. Maybe you're doing something that improves the efficacy of your ad, but generally speaking, that is going to be, you know, pushed back down by competition and by, you know, Google's growing ad prices. And so in general, what you're getting is this, this boulder pushing phenomenon. You're pushing a boulder up the hill. Every single ad costs you, you know, the same amount. Every new customer costs you the same amount. You're not gaining efficiency. Right, the slope of that hill generally is staying the same over time. Maybe it flattens a little bit, maybe it steepens a little bit, but you aren't getting this sort of flywheel effect. The flywheel effect is the opposite, right? Essentially, every time you make an investment, let's say, for example, much of your audience is familiar with SEO, so let's use SEO as an example, right? And content marketing. So I produce a piece of content. It reaches a small audience and maybe it earns a link or two. And then what happens the next time I produce a piece of content? Maybe it reaches a slightly bigger audience because a few more people have signed up for the email subscription, right, to our blog. And maybe we got a couple more links. And so we rank a little bit better in Google. And so that next piece of content does a little bit better. And then we do it again. And 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 eventually, we are getting a lot of traffic for the same effort that we put in when we were getting very little traffic, which is the opposite of what you do with advertising, right? Advertising, every single click costs about the same, right? Every conversion costs about the same. It's scalable. It's easy to do, right? That's why every one of your competitors is investing in it. Content is hard. It takes a lot of time in order to build up that flywheel energy and engine. Takes oftentimes years. But wow, when you do it, oh, it's a superpower. So my philosophy is when you are trying to build your marketing engine, concentrate more energy on building that flywheel so that you have a sustainable growth system that gives you more returns for each investment that you make. That can be, you know, that can make marketing a competitive advantage. And not a ton of companies have marketing as a competitive advantage. So it is quite unique. It can help you overcome barriers in other parts of your business. It can help you with your cost of customer acquisition. It can help you with your return on investment. It can help you get to profitability and survive longer than your competition. It's a superpower.
I tend to agree. Yeah, that's a lovely take on that, Rand. Rand, we have come to almost the last section of the podcast, and by our own objective observation, this is the most fun part of the podcast also, which is called the rapid fire round.
Nice.
I hope you like it too.
Yeah.
And the way it's going to work, the way it's going to work is I'm going to shoot about 5 questions at you, and my questions are going to be short and quick, but your answers don't have to be short and quick. You can take your time to answer that. And I hope you enjoy it. Are you ready, Ryan?
I am ready.
All right. And I'm so thankful the lottery to run this round today came to me. So honored to do that. So question number one, I have a quote in front of me that I have taken the liberty to paraphrase. The quote is from you, which says, every startup should pick up an enemy. It could be the old ways of marketing. It could be a competitor, et cetera, et cetera. Why or why not? Do you agree with that statement?
Yeah, I love this statement. I love having an antagonist. I think it gives you a force to fight against. I think the power, you know, human beings are just trained to have a common enemy and to want to fight against them. And there's so much in the world that needs to be changed, right? There's so much injustice and so many problems. The whole idea of starting a company or starting a podcast or starting a blog, whatever you're starting, is that there is an unsolved problem out there. And so if you pick not only a problem, but an antagonist, an enemy, right? A force or a company or a dominant way of thinking that you're fighting against, awesome. That is awesome. I love it.
Great. And if you were to start a company like SEO Moz or Moz, what's one thing that you would do differently again?
So many things. Oh my God. Manish, how could you ask me one thing? One thing. I wrote a whole book about things I would do differently. All right, I'll pick one at random. You know what? I would not have tried to grow the company nearly as big as I did. One of the things that I believed in my early years, you know, in my 20s, even in my early 30s, was that you were, as an entrepreneur and a CEO, you were more impressive the more employees you had. It was not, you know, revenue was nice, right? And growth was nice and blah, blah, blah. But employees, right? If you had 100 people on your team, oh, well, now you're a really impressive CEO. And I fell for that. I fell hard for that myth. And I would not do that again. I think now I am far, far more impressed by CEOs and founders who have the discipline to keep their companies really small, 4 people, 5 people, 7 people, versus those who tout, oh yeah, you know, we have 200 people on our team. And nope, my friend, you are optimizing for the wrong metric. Small companies, I think small companies are beautiful, wonderful things. They're things that I want to support. They're things that we should all want to see more of in the world, because more small companies means less income inequality. It means more distribution of wealth. It means a better macroeconomic picture, right? A healthier economy. It means less money and power in politics, right? From the corporate world, which I think is something we all know is quite negative. So it's just universally a positive thing. I love to see small companies. I want to keep SparkToro small. If I were doing Moz again, I would have kept it small.
I love that answer, and I can totally relate to it. I didn't think of it from the same lens that you described, but I think Yag will be very happy to agree with you as well, because he's the startup guy. He always loves to work in small teams and succeed at it. So
I'm smiling and nodding all the way.
Yeah. There's so many beautiful things about small. The other, you know, one of the huge advantages that I never realized until Moz got very big is how much easier communication internally is.
Absolutely.
Right. If you want to try and get even 10 or 20 or 50 people on board with an idea, that is so much easier than 200 or 500. And having everybody on the team believing in the idea, working toward the same goals, aware of each other, thinking of each other as human beings rather than as, Oh, I hate the engineering team. Oh, I hate that marketing team. Oh, I hate that legal team, right? Instead, it's, oh, I really like Yag. I really like Manish. I really like Casey. I really like Rand. But that's what you want, right? You want people to think of people as people. So there's no substitute for small.
Agreed, agreed. Well, without wasting too much time, we are about to touch upon the 40-minute mark. So question number three, Rand. If you were to give us a summary, one-line summary of your book, Lost and Founder, what would that be?
Reading Lost and Founder is like going to a coffee shop with Rand and asking him all the right questions about what to do and not to do building a startup.
Awesome. That's just great.
Look at that, one line. Amazing. How did I do it?
That's amazing. I'm sorry, I'm sticking with one. Maybe I could have expanded it to 3 points, but I think it...
No. One is perfect. I need to be more succinct.
Question number four. What was a fact in SEO, search engine optimization, which, when you first came to know, blew your mind, and why?
Ooh, yeah. One of the early ones that blew my mind, this must have been back in 2005, 2006, I think, when they first announced it. And it's still true today, to a slightly lesser degree. But Google, I remember they were at an event. I think it was, you know, one of the old SES events that they used to do at their headquarters in Mountain View. And they announced that 20% of all searches every day were new searches. Basically, they had never seen anyone search for that combination of words and phrases before in the history of Google, right? So this is, what, 7 years into Google's life, and they're telling us 20% of all searches every day are completely new. And that gave me that sense of, oh my God, that is wild, right? This, the opportunity in content and in niche building of content is extraordinary. And that by, you know, serving audiences well with content online, you know, I could build a really exciting transformative business and help other people do the same. That stat blew me away. I believe they have since updated it. A few years ago, it was 18%. I think now it's 15 or 16%. But still, right? 15% of all queries are new every day, 21 years into Google's history. That's mind-bending.
Still in the same range, which is weird to imagine. That's amazing. And the last and final question, number five. Which of these professional identities describe you best, or which one do you relate to the most as an SEO marketer or a CEO or that of a founder?
I think founder. Founder probably describes me best, right? I like building things. I've founded a few projects and a few companies now. I'm no longer in SEO. Someone was, you know, asking me like, well, but you're really well followed in SEO. I'm like, yeah, but I couldn't even tell you what all the schema markup options are anymore, right? Like, I haven't paid attention to SEO world deeply since leaving Moz in 2018. So I am definitely a founder. If I had to add one more, I'd say I'm also a marketer, right? I do love marketing. I love sharing ideas with people. I love teaching them. I love to amplify and support things and reach people with those ideas. But founder is probably the best one.
Love it. And you're not a marketer. You're probably the marketer for a lot of people.
That's very kind. I will endeavor to do my best to live up to that.
Awesome. So we have come to the end of the podcast, Rand. So we would love to take a parting message from you for our audience, if you have one.
Sure. I am a big believer in being the exception to the rule. So if everyone is doing things one way in your field or in your country or in your market, I think there is huge value in thinking differently and choosing a different path. And that goes for how you build your company. That goes for how you create your content. That goes for how you market. When you find opportunities that are outside the mainstream, that tends to be where really exciting, interesting things happen.
Amazing. And after listening to this podcast, if somebody wants to connect with you, I know, of course, you know, you're just one search away, but what's your most preferred way of people connecting with you?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'd love to tell folks to go give SparkToro a spin. It's totally free to try it out. You can just go to sparktoro.com and start searching. And if you want to follow what I'm up to, the blog there at SparkToro is a great place to do that. And if you're looking for sort of more all of Rand's thoughts, I am most active on Twitter, where I'm at RandFish.
Lovely. And thank you once again, Rand. You know, it's been amazing to have you today and have this great conversation. So thank you for joining us.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks, you guys. I really appreciate it.
All right, folks. So that's that with the ABM Conversations podcast today. And until we catch up with you the next time, this is bye from me, Yag.
And this is bye from me, Manish. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the ABM Conversations podcast. Make sure you subscribe and share your comments with us. We're constantly looking for your feedback, thoughts, and suggestions to make the show more relevant to you.